Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios.
It's Monday, August 24th.
After last week's Democratic convention, here we are on the first day of the Republican convention. It looks like it's beginning as a living representation of the mixed messages that President Trump has been giving all year about the coronavirus, and with questions about how seriously he takes the movement for racial justice and police accountability. But as we all know, the police killing of George Floyd is transforming the conversation about police violence and racial justice generally in this country. But that as the convention begins, the president's language, as of last week, barely acknowledges any need for reform.
But Biden and Harris are pro-crime and anti-cop. There's no other way to say it. And we're anti-crime. We are pro-cop all the way. I've gotten the endorsement. I got the endorsement. Pat Lynch, New York City Police.
President Trump last week. So will the Republican convention take this issue seriously or just condemn the movement as the mob, a word the president likes to use? Which path will they see as to their political advantage? Tonight, as it happens, the only black Republican in the Senate, Tim Scott of South Carolina, will be one of the speakers. Let's see if he tries to defend Trump's record on this in general or references the shooting of Jacob Blake in the back seven times at all. And as for the virus, they are in Charlotte, North Carolina, right? We remember that Trump canceled the original plan for the Charlotte convention because the Democratic governor, Roy Cooper, was insisting on social distancing. Trump was then going to move it to Jacksonville, Florida, remember? Where the Republican governor was going to allow full attendance indoors in a convention hall. But after Florida opened up too quickly and the outbreak in the state got worse, Trump acknowledged reality back on July 23rd.
I'll still do a convention speech in a different form, but we won't do a big crowded convention per se. It's just not the right time for that.
So it's back to Charlotte and with the social distancing rules, but he still wants to make a show of something more in person than the Democrats had, leaning toward his argument that things should reopen more quickly. Today's roll call vote, that nomination vote, for example, which was all on video, or I think 49 of the 50 states were on video, plus seven territories, during the Democratic convention, and they were having fun with the different scenes of the different states and calamari from Rhode Island and all of that stuff. Instead, the Republican version today will feature more than 300 delegates in person, indoors, required to submit to temperature checks, but not to get tested for asymptomatic cases. They will have to wear masks, and I read that they will have to stay distanced. I don't know if it's 6 feet or whatever their standard is, but you could see how the contradictions are fully on display. Can they have it both ways? Adhering to the rules that the governor of North Carolina wanted in the first place while making a show of opening more quickly than the Democrats did. With me now, Associated Press, White House correspondent Amer Madani, now covering President Trump's reelection campaign. Prior to joining the AP last year, Amer was a longtime correspondent for USA Today, where he had served as White House correspondent and Baghdad bureau chief. Most recently, he was USA Today's Chicago-based national correspondent, covering stories including the 2020 presidential campaign, policing in America, and more. Amer's latest article, published yesterday, is called "The Bully Pulpit: Trump Pushes Washington, But the Virus Resists." Amer, great to have you with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Hey, thanks for having me, Brian.
So as someone who has covered both policing in the Midwest and the 2020 Trump campaign, how do you see them intersecting today or not after the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin yesterday?
You know, I don't have any direct insight since last night of what happened in Wisconsin, but generally speaking, I don't see him particularly connecting this Wisconsin case. I, of course, could be wrong. But I think, you know, as you pretty much laid out really well, he wants to connect Democratic cities as being these bastions of violence, and that Democratic mayors have put up with too much looting and disregard for law. And he's going to pivot towards this main theme, right, that he's looking at as part of his campaign as the law and order president. You know, he's ripping a page out of the Nixon playbook on this. It's so eerily similar. But I don't see him going too deep in trying to be reflective tonight in his various appearances, or really any of the folks that are going to be on the stage over the next four nights, really going too far deep in trying to say we need to have some sort of reckoning or reconsideration as a people about where we are with racial injustice and police brutality.
Which means we'll wind up with two very polarized parties from what you're describing, because the Democrats last week, to be fair, avoided talk of crime on the rise this year that the Republicans want to attribute to the racial justice and the police accountability movement. The Democrats ducked even the parts of the crime wave that are real. That could be a vulnerability for them. Now we see the other side, politically speaking. I guess you're saying your coverage of the president indicates that he is not going to address racial justice generally or police accountability specifically in any kind of big way, like time for a big reckoning, as you used that word. He will just duck those whole topics?
Oh, I think so. I think it's going to very much focus on the chaos, and that there's been a surge in crime in some big cities like New York and Chicago, Philadelphia, elsewhere. But I think sort of the problem, and as part of the media, and as someone who, you know, for a big chunk of my career has covered crime in big cities and violence, what we often forget, especially in these recent years, and that violence itself, we're still near, when we look as a nation, we're near historic lows. And I'm not in any way condoning terrible violence and people's lives that are lost to gun violence. But let's put this in a big perspective. Yes, we've had some pockets that are related to some broader things that are going on right now. But overall, as a nation, and especially when you look over the last, you know, 50 years of where we are, we're back down very close to where those lows were 50 years in homicides and shooting levels, if we set aside sort of the spurt that we've seen this summer in gun violence in cities, and only in a few cities. And I think that gets lost in the conversation as well. And a lot of the conversation, I think, also missed some of the practical aspects. You know, I've spent a lot of the last few years of my career in Chicago, where there's now about 13,000 or 12,500 cops. That's, I think, second still only to New York. There's more cops in Chicago than LA. In the last decade, Chicago spent about $1 billion, a billion with a B, on police settlements. I don't hear in this conversation also sort of a practical sense of, can cities even afford to police the way that they're policing? You know, there just seems, regardless of what side you're on the issue, though I think it's really, there isn't sides, there's a broad spectrum on this. People aren't talking about this in sort of a practical way, and that we just can't afford to sort of go at it the way we've been going at it for such a long time when it comes to policing.
With your experience reporting from Chicago, including on policing and crime issues, what do you see as the reason for the spike in shootings in Chicago this year?
Well, it's been a very difficult summer. We've had a pandemic. We had the George Floyd having this reckoning. We have a lot of young people that are unemployed. When you look at a place like Chicago, which I could speak to better than New York or Philadelphia or L.A., a vast majority of the shootings that occur in Chicago happen in about five different neighborhoods that have intense levels of poverty, intense levels of, gangs, the ideas of gangs have even changed, but where there isn't a whole lot of opportunity. There's a deficit in education from the parts of the city where I live and where my child goes to school, then some of these kids that you hear about that make national news that get hit by a stray bullet. And that aspect, I think is kind of getting missed in this whole conversation we're having about violence in cities right now.
Is there any indication yet what Senator Scott's convention speech will be about tonight? And again, that's Senator Tim Scott, Republican from South Carolina, scheduled to speak this evening, the only black Republican in the Senate. But will he defend Trump on race per se, or Trump's sort of lack of attention to police accountability? Do we know what Senator Scott is going to say?
I don't know what Senator Scott is going to say today, but the theme of today is the land of promise. On Tuesday, they're talking about the land of opportunity, and then Wednesday's the land of heroes, and then Thursday, when Trump speaks, the theme is land of greatness. What Trump has promised with this convention and how he says he's going to differentiate is that this is going to be more positive than what he says. His take on the Democrats was that last week's convention was too dark, and he's going to stand apart from the Democrats because the programming will be far more positive, and will show what the future could lay out for the country. The problem, though, that President Trump has going into this convention is, we have, some 177,000 dead from the virus. Nearly 30 million of Americans are receiving some type of unemployment aid. Last week, jobless claims ticked up again. It's a tall order to push to optimism on Americans during this really, really dark period.
Let's transition to the virus now, which you just brought up. Your latest article, published yesterday, is called "The Bully Pulpit: Trump Pushes Washington, But the Virus Resists." And when you say Trump claims that he'll have a more positive convention than the Democrats, I'm sure it'll be more positive with respect to his successes regarding the coronavirus and more negative with respect to what he says would happen if the Democrats gain the White House. But you write that the president has transformed a public health crisis into a political litmus test. What do you mean by litmus test there?
Well, it's now become this culture war, almost every aspect of how we look at it. And you go to some of these swing or swingish battleground states, whether you wear a mask or not, how you're paying attention to your public health officials. Everything about this process, which shouldn't be politicized, it should be science, has become a political choice. And he's framed it this way, and he's gone. The problem also with the president is on things like masks, for example. He's been all over the issue on it. First, it was because the health officials were saying no masks because there was a concern about the amount of PPE. So the federal government stance was that way. Then it was, well, we're recommending you wear a mask, but it's a recommendation. You don't have to do it. Eventually, in recent months, he's fallen on the side, well, wear a mask. But then when there's opportunities to side with cultural warriors on the idea of the government pushing a mask on you and mandating it and using it as a political cudgel against Biden, who's basically said that he'd be open to a mandate, a federal mandate for masks to try to finally stamp out this disease. He said, don't let why should all states be treated the same? And he's turned it into a states' rights issue. And we're at this moment, you know, where no matter really where you live in the country, if you're wanting to get back to a sense of normalcy, there seems to need to be some unity in how we approach this.
And it is interesting that I'm sure Trump will take credit for the fact that some of the states in the South and West that have been seeing spikes in coronavirus cases and deaths this summer, the new cases rate is starting to decline. But there's an article in the New York Times today that breaks it down more locally than that within these states and says it's the areas that have imposed local mask requirements where the new case rate seems to be leveling off. So the convention optics, to continue on what you were saying, it's kind of going to be this mishmash, I guess, from what I'm reading. He's going to have this in-person convention in parts in Charlotte, like the roll call vote today, with 300 plus delegates. So they'll be in person, but they will be separated by however many feet. And there is a mask mandate in order to get in the convention hall, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong. So how do the optics of that all play out for or against Trump?
Right. So, you know, one, the camera's always on him. So I don't know. I think it'll get brought up by reporters. I was hearing from a colleague this morning. I'm not in Charlotte today, but that somebody that had shown up early to the convention hall, and there were a lot of people without masks on. I'm sure that'll change over time, and that's something you see that just in general with some of these events. It's all over the place. I think played some sound leading into this from his event at Bedminster, where he had the New York Police Union.
Yeah.
You get a smattering is what happens with all of these events. Some of the cops were wearing masks, some of them weren't. And I imagine you'll see a lot of that at a lot of these events. A lot of the events are going to be outdoors. Some of the big ones, the First Lady is speaking in the Rose Garden, and my schedule, I'm pretty sure that's tomorrow that she's speaking. Trump himself will give his big acceptance speech on the South Lawn, again, outdoors. Pence is speaking outdoors. So, you know, there's a mix of these things. And, you know, the outdoor venues allow for a little bit more social distancing. A little more social distancing with the outdoor events.
Oh, because they have more space.
You have more space to spread out. You have the hopefully a breeze and some fresh air that also sort of mitigates some of the risks for folks. But, you know, I think that, you know, it's been played over and over again. We've seen this, you know, if you're watching the news carefully, it's there. You watch it at every rally, at every event, you know, there's masked people and there's not masked people. You know, to borrow the president's phrase at this point, it is what it is.
And we're now approaching 180,000 coronavirus deaths in this country. That's the is in it is what it is when he referred to deaths that way in the interview the other week. And the tension continues over the 1,000 deaths a day this summer, more than any other country, more than all of Europe combined, and Europe has many more people than the United States. While the president repeatedly declares victory and urges people to get on with their lives like it's over, which causes more virus. Here's what President Trump said in April, taking credit for already limiting the death toll.
The minimum number was 100,000 lives, and I think we'll be substantially under that number. Hard to believe that if you had 60,000, you can never be happy, but that's a lot fewer than we were originally told and thinking.
So now, of course, we're approaching 180,000. If this 1,000 deaths a week pace that's been going on all summer continues the 10 more weeks till Election Day, we're going to be right around 250,000 deaths at the time that the in-person votes are cast on Election Day itself. So how will he try to portray the current situation as a success on his part this week?
Well, I think what we've seen already is that he makes a claim if he didn't shut down travel when he did, that we could have had millions that would have been killed. I think there's also this other aspect of it, like for Americans, and I'm interested in seeing how this plays out in the week ahead and how people weigh their choices. But economists are even talking more and more about this. Trump likes to claim that there's going to be a V-shaped recovery, but there's kind of something now that it's a K-shaped recovery, right? So if you're lucky enough to have a white-collar job and a job where you're lucky enough to work from home and sit on your laptop and have a 401k, you might be in a better place financially than you were at the beginning of this year, if you're part of that cohort of people. But then there's the bottom, the people that work.
How about the bottom 99% whose wealth doesn't come primarily from stocks?
Right, exactly. So, where that's not the stock market isn't the economy, where you're one of the 30 million people receiving some type of unemployment benefit right now. And that's, going back to what I said before, it's a really dark period for a lot of these Americans. And I think, as you're sort of prediction games, I think it's a fool's game.
Pointless,
it's pointless. But we know things about how elections are and how, it's as Reagan said, do you feel better off now than you did 4 years ago? And I guess the point I'm making is if you're employed, I think you can. It's a broader question, and there's more to it than for the other 10.5% at least that are sitting at home right now and not being able to get a paycheck. And you just look back since 1956 and the year before the election. So we've had 9 incumbent presidents. Only one lost. When the unemployment fell over that year, Ford in 76, and only one was reelected when it rose, Eisenhower in 56. The virus wasn't of Trump's making, but historically we've judged presidents on the economy that they've left us with on election day.
We're almost out of time. The Democrats, of course, played up Joe Biden's empathy and other character traits to draw a contrast with Trump. Along those lines, as it happens in the news today, I guess leaked just in time for the Republican convention on purpose, is audio of Trump's sister, Marianne, a retired judge who has refrained from criticizing him in public before. Trump's sister talking to his niece, Mary Trump, who just wrote that critical book. But the sister, Marianne, had been part of the lawsuit to try to block the publication of the book. So she was on Donald's side in that respect. But here's this audio tape of her saying this, as obtained by the Washington Post, about Donald Trump's character.
Goddamn tweet and the lie. Oh my God, I'm talking too freely, but it is the change of stories, the lack of preparation, the lying, the holy
Right. So obviously the last word was bleeped, and if the whole thing was a little off mic for you, the text was, this goddamn tweet and the lying, oh my God, I'm talking too freely, but the change of stories, the lack of preparation, the lying, the holy S. So, Amer, does any of this matter politically? Of course, it's too early to tell, but I think so many people who voted for Trump, even in 2016, were like, the guy's personal character, shaky, right. But that's not why I vote for a president or not.
I hate the prediction business, but we know the Access Hollywood tape didn't change too many minds as far as we could tell from the final results of the election. At the end of the day, I guess, does this help bring, if you're a Democrat, does it help bring more people on the fence that you're pushing? Does it bring the excitement and motivate people to get out and vote? At this point, it's who can get the most bodies to the polls or to the mail in time. That's what it's all about. There's very few people who don't have an opinion strongly about this president one way or another. And I'm not sure if titillating secretly recorded videotapes of his sister saying not so nice things about him matter.
Amar Madani, AP White House correspondent covering the Trump campaign. Thanks so much for the time today. Love to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.